From Interfaith Alliance, this is State of Belief Radio. I'm your host, Reverend Welton Gaddy, broadcasting this week from Monroe, Louisiana. State of Belief airs every weekend on radio stations nationwide. It's available as a podcast on iTunes and other leading podcast platforms. I hope you'll take advantage of that. I urge you to subscribe to it today. Now, this program is made possible in great part by the generous support of our listeners. If you've made a donation this week, please let me say a very sincere thank you. If you haven't pitched in yet, information on how you can help keep this show on the air is available at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. We would love to hear from you. Now, here's what's coming up this week on State of Belief Radio.
The Bible's against it. God's against it. I'm against it.
In a recent sermon, the Baptist pastor, Charles Worley, suggested gays and lesbians should be imprisoned behind an electric fence.
Faith is an incredibly powerful thing. It can encourage peace, but it can equally be used to spark war. It can teach love, but it can be perverted to inspire hate. And tragically, that can easily include corrosive, soul-crushing self-hate. It continues to happen in faith communities across the country, specifically to LGBTQ persons of faith. Thankfully, an organization dedicated to at least identifying dangerous religious environments continues to grow and expand. We profiled Church Clarity last year, and we'll follow up with Database Director Sarah Noon on this week's State of Belief Radio.
Every day I've received handwritten letters, I receive Facebook messages, people find me online, and they write me an email of people saying, you know, you wrapped words around all the things that are in my heart.
How was it a surprise? Theologian Jacqueline Bussey, whose award-winning first book was bluntly titled Outlaw Christian, writes a new book that's both inspiring and provocative, but the publisher acts shocked and refuses to release the second book. It's a story we've heard before. Thankfully, another publisher, Fortress Press, stepped up and published the book, which is why I am right now holding Love Without Limits, Jesus' Radical Vision for Love with No Exceptions. We will welcome Dr. Bussey back to the show later in this hour as part of our special series called Whosoever You Love. But first,
hey, I watched when the World Trade Center came tumbling down. And I watched in Jersey City, New Jersey, where thousands and thousands of people were cheering as that building was coming down. Thousands of people were cheering.
This past Tuesday marked 17 years since the world all Americans knew changed. Changed forever. As tragic and unprecedented as the deadly attacks of September 11, 2001 were, the way our leaders misappropriated our grief and the world's outrage continues to echo around the globe today, resolutely continuing to raise their voices in resistance are a dedicated group of survivors organized under the name September 11 Families for Peaceful Tomorrows. With the sad anniversary of the 9/11 attacks just days ago, I am very grateful to be able to welcome Nancy Meyer of September 11 Families to State of Belief Radio. Nancy, I am sorry for your loss. I thank you for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you, and thank you for that welcome.
There is so much that every single one of us can learn from the approach that you and your fellow activists have taken to the heartbreak of that day in 2001. Would you talk about how you personally arrived at the place of peacemaking rather than retribution?
The organization formed in a small group of people who lived in New York City or in around New York City. They had an online presence, which I stumbled across around 2004. And when I saw what they were doing and their belief system, I knew immediately that that was a group that I could join and that I believed in what they were doing. Mm-hmm. And that felt very natural to me, their approach.
If you had found them earlier in your own pilgrimage, would you have wanted to do that then, or was it a long process to come to where you were that made you want to join that group of people?
Oh, I absolutely would have joined up with them as soon as I heard about them, even if it had been the day after.
Hmm.
The nation's reaction to the tragedy has been so unbelievable to me. It's just something that I don't really even relate to. And this group has taken a different approach. The idea of the group is that, it's embodied in our name, because there is a quote by Martin Luther King, "Wars are poor chisels for carving out peaceful tomorrows."
Mm-hmm.
And that's where we got our name. The idea being that, we rushed to war immediately afterward and in response to the tragedy. And it just seemed like absolutely the wrong approach.
Mm-hmm.
And so being appalled at that for years, I would have definitely joined the group as soon as I, had heard of them, mm-hmm. whenever that was.
I know that you followed your own painful journey in terms of religious faith. That's true of most of the people who are listeners to this program. I think it's always immensely useful for people who may be on the same path to know that they're not alone. And so I wonder if you'd be willing to talk just a little bit about where you've been in terms of faith, where you are today, and how you got to where you are.
Yeah, I was raised a Catholic, and my very first friend before I ever went to school, her name was Katie.
Mm-hmm.
And I was pretty concerned when I learned that she wouldn't go to the same school I was going to, because she was going to public school and I was being sent to Catholic school. And so that was my first understanding that she was somehow different, and that was seemed to be a thing that kept us apart.
Mm-hmm.
When I was in Catholic school, they told me that anyone who wasn't a Catholic wasn't going to heaven.
Mm-hmm.
And, even as a small child, I understood that that can't be right.
Mm-hmm.
I couldn't understand it because I knew that Katie was adopted.
Mm-hmm.
And I asked my mother, why did God not let Katie grow up with her own parents, her
mm-hmm.
original parents? And she told me that God loved Katie and wanted her to have a family that was really good for her, et cetera. And so I couldn't understand why, if God loved Katie so much, why would that,
mm-hmm.
that be the situation? And so it planted the seed in me that I just knew that can't be right, that
mm-hmm.
people should be kept apart or discriminated against just on faith. And so as I got older, it just became more and more obvious to me that the Catholic faith wasn't my spiritual home.
Mm-hmm.
And I just moved into looking at what other people believed, and it finally occurred to me that there need not be any belief
mm-hmm.
In an individual, in a deity, that people can live just as humans and have a moral compass without having that dictated to them by any kind of religious authority, whether it's a book or a person.
Mm-hmm.
And that's how I've lived my life. That's how I've raised my children.
Mm-hmm. How did you deal with 9/11, where did you find your sources of strength and comfort and encouragement?
Well, actually, our organization is pretty buoyed up by the solidarity that we get from talking with other people. We've found quite a few people and organizations, I should say, who have been very supportive of our of how we approach the issue. Phrasing that is in our founding documents is not in our name. Those words really underscore how we feel about the response to 9/11. We are family members of civilians who were killed. And we knew as soon as we saw the march to war being developed and some of the other antagonistic and violent responses, even here at home, we felt like that was a very poor choice or poor way to use our sacrifice. And in a sense, it cheapened it. And I feel like that not in our name is a significant way to explain that, you know, don't use our suffering. Don't use our sacrifice. Don't use our family's tragic experience to justify more violence against more people who will feel the same way we do.
Yeah. What do you wish people who have been spared the kind of trauma that you've survived could understand about why this kind of activism is so important?
Well, you know, I guess I would say that one of the things that really bothered me right after September 11th and continues to do so each year on that date is that how people in the U.S. have taken it so personally and seem to almost enjoy the drama of the event. You know, many people would rush up and tell me, for example, how they knew someone who had once visited the Twin Towers, or how their neighbor's wife's aunt's friend worked at the Pentagon. It's almost creepy how some folks seem to want to have a connection when you consider how painful actually having the connection is. And what a lot of Americans don't understand is that to those of us for whom it was a personal experience, they are disrespecting us with that reaction. They are disrespecting the sacrifice of our family members who were civilians, remember. You know, with their mindless flag waving and American supremacy chest thumping and recurring desire to recreate the emotion in what becomes really a melodramatic way. I view this as America's collective chewing on a sore tooth rather than introspection as to why this happened and constructive ways to prevent it from happening again. I think that's where some real productive activity can take place. I think that we need to remember that how you react to 9/11 at the time and continuing through time, you know, that needs to be respectful to not just the families who lost one of the nearly 3,000 people killed that day, but the rescue workers who died later, the soldiers who died and continue to die in two ongoing wars of retribution, and in particular, the hundreds of thousands of civilians like us, like our families, who have lost and they continue to lose their lives and their health and their loved ones from the violence that is a direct result of the tragedy. And by the way, the media is highly complicit in this. You know, they promote all of this for their own purposes, and many of us don't watch any media around this time of year for that reason.
Do you think there ought to be a time in the very near future where we quit what I would call almost celebrating 9/11 and get on with what you're talking about, still grieving as responsibly as you would for the people lost, but not keep waving the flag around that and using it as a way to look negatively at the world?
Oh, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you'd think that after 17 years, we would have learned to move away from the anger phase, grieving.
Right.
and learn that the enemy is not any one faith or ideology or nationality or even a practice.
Mm-hmm.
It's our unwillingness to understand, accept each other, and to cultivate bonds of empathy, mm-hmm. not to resort to extremist actions of our own,
yeah.
Whether they're terrorism with bombs or at a grand scale, like in war, because after all, war is terrorism with a mm-hmm. bigger budget. And it can also just manifest, you know, at your local market where people will verbally attack strangers based solely on who they think they are.
Right.
These are extremist reactions. They don't help. They don't break the cycle of violence. They don't engender peace. They don't really heal anything.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I absolutely believe that that is something we need to move on from. We are much bigger than that.
Right, right. Looking back, what would you say that you've learned that you wished you had known a long time ago, maybe something other people could learn from without going through what you've gone through?
Well, you know, that's a hard one to answer. I think that, you know, we're all always continuously striving for a better future. And, you know, everyone wants to move toward a world where we are closer to supporting rather than harming one another.
Mm-hmm.
That
right.
intellectually is an acceptable thought, an acceptable idea for most people. But it's how we behave in that way mm-hmm. that we need to remember from a day-to-day basis. Connect and work with those who have experienced deep losses due to violence and understand, you know, what they're going through, what they want, and how that can break the cycle mm-hmm. of violence. Gandhi said, an eye for an eye leaves the whole world blind. And we really need to remember that. We really need to curb our own worst impulses and try to consider how to educate ourselves with ways of doing that and ways of practicing that, you know, every single day. Even if it's just smiling at a stranger or acting as an example to others when, you know, you see people who aren't like yourself. And just remembering to conduct yourself in a respectful manner and remember the humanity of the other person, even when that other person may be behaving in inhumane way to you.
Nancy Myers' sister-in-law was on United Flight 93 that terrible day 17 years ago and died in a field in Pennsylvania along with 48 other passengers and crew. She was 3 months pregnant. Nancy Meyer has been a speaker and activist with September 11th Families for Peaceful Tomorrows since 2004. Nancy, I so appreciate you being with us on State of Belief Radio.
Well, thank you very much. And I would like to mention our website, peacefultomorrows.org. You can learn a lot more about what our organization does there.
There's lots more still to come on this week's show. We'll hear from Sarah New of the organization Church Clarity. And up next, outlaw Christian author Jacqueline Bussey. Her new book is titled Love Without Limits, Jesus' Radical Vision for Love with No Exceptions. I'm Welton Gaddy. You're listening to State of Belief Radio, brought to you by Interfaith Alliance. A couple of years ago, we were fortunate to have Dr. Jacqueline Bussey on the show to talk about her then new book, Outlaw Christian. It was a call for authenticity in faith and in life. Now, Dr. Bussey is back with a new book titled Love Without Limits, Jesus' Radical Vision for Love with No Exceptions. And I am delighted that it brings Jacqueline back to State of Belief as part of our ongoing series, Whosoever You Love. Jacqueline, thank you for being with us again.
Thank you for having me on again.
Let's start by you talking about what made you want to write this particular book and how it continues the generous teachings of your first book?
Well, essentially, this was a book that was written during the election year, and I found myself waking up in the morning and feeling torn apart by the level of division in our nation. And so I wanted to write a book about love across difference and division. That's what I did. And it ended up being a test, really, of my own authenticity in the end, in ways I did not expect.
No exceptions. What's that mean?
Well, it means literally no exceptions. And the backstory to the book is that my original Christian publisher asked me to make exceptions to Jesus's radical vision of love. And I was not permitted by that publisher to tell certain stories about, in particular, some of my interfaith neighbors, some of my Muslim brothers and sisters whose stories of love that I had shared.
Why is the absolute love that you ascribed to Jesus so critically important?
Well, it's so critical, I think, because we all see today the epic fails of love that are occurring in our society, that are occurring within our own hearts. And we have to do better. We're a country that's torn apart. We're torn apart from our neighbors. And Jesus summoned us to widen our wingspan of love. And that's what I'm trying to summon us to do in the contemporary day.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, there's a clever little game some self-proclaimed Christians play with the word love. It's the hate the sin, love the sinner technique. And it places the burden of getting right with the Lord on the sinner, which of course means I, the good Christian, get to decide what is sin. Would you talk about that?
Yeah, that's absolutely true. I think the real problem there is that we tend to, because we're all sinners, right? We all tend, Christians tend to rank sins.
Yeah.
The sins, quote unquote, that I'm not a part of, those are always the worst ones. Those are the ones that get you thrown out of church. Those are the ones, you know, that you should be sent to the sidelines for. This is the problem, right? If all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God, as the Bible says, then we have to start new. Everyone is starting, you know, basically with the same slate.
Yeah.
And for me, that means that we have to widen love's wingspan and love without exceptions, no matter how hard that is.
There are a lot of people who think of love as so soft, I would say, that it doesn't even relate to politics. Talk about that, if you will.
Yeah. Well, I tend to agree with those folks who say that, you know, justice is what love looks like in public.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I don't think there's anything soft about love at all.
Right.
I think that Jesus's radical vision of love got him killed, because I think people saw how threatening it actually was to the elites, you know, to those who had always held all the power. You know, I think there's always folks in every society who want to be able to decide who's in and who's out,
mm-hmm.
who's worthy of love and who's not, who's a sinner, who's a saint. And Jesus disrupts all of that, and I think contemporary Christians should too.
The difficulties that you had in getting this book published, it is a good illustration of the need for this book just in what happened to you. This is not the first time that that's happened in trying to get a book published. Our friend Brandon Robertson went through something similar with the purportedly Christian publisher turning down his manuscript for Nomad. That was eventually released by another publisher. I remember in one of my publishing experiences, the same thing happened. They said, you can't have these stories in here. In your case, what on earth did you put in this new book that made your publisher reject it, even though your previous book was very clearly titled with the actual words, quote, Outlaw Christian?
I know. It's so ironic, isn't it? Well, I can give you two examples that they insisted that I delete, which I refused to delete, which caused me to lose the contract.
Mm-hmm.
Well, the first was a story of a couple, a true story of my neighbors, who adopted a special needs baby who was born addicted to drugs and alcohol. And watching them, you know, take care of this child and loving across, you know, having this love for the child that had nothing to do with biology, right?
Mm-hmm.
I was so in awe of them, and they happened to be a gay couple. And I was asked to cut every word of that story, which was over 3,000 words from the entire manuscript. It's almost a whole chapter. And then on the interfaith chapter, where I was discussing, you know, stories about my Muslim brothers and sisters, I was asked to cut a story, again, a true story, in which I talked about traveling to the Middle East and worshiping in a Christian church next to Christians who spoke Arabic. And when they were referring to God in Arabic, and again, they're Christian, they refer to God as Allah.
Mm-hmm.
And I was sharing that the word Allah is simply the Arabic word for God, even if one is Christian or Jew or Muslim. And then, of course, I went to talk about the ways in which our Muslim neighbors understand that to be the same God of Abraham and Jacob and Isaac that Christians and Jews believe they're worshiping. And again, I was told all of that had to go.
Mm-hmm. What does this experience teach us about the state of what I'll call contemporary commercial Christianity?
Yeah, it teaches us something not so good, right? It teaches us that powers that be are controlling the narrative and allowing only a single story about certain folks to be told. Mm-hmm. And that's tragic because nobody wants a single story told about them. You know, no one group should be defined by the actions of any one person. So, I think it's showing that the Christian publishing industry does not reflect the actual diversity of lived Christianity on the ground.
Mm-hmm.
And that's tragic. It's not authentic, right? It's not real. And that's why I went and took my story online. You know, I decided to go on Facebook and tell the story about what had happened to my book. I don't name my publisher. I'm not interested in that. As you say, well, there's so many people who've had this happen to them. It's really, you know, just emblematic of Christian publishing right now, but also of our society. We just want to silence and reject and censor. We don't want to have a dialogue and listen and get to know one another. And I feel that what happened to the book just proves the message of the book all the more, which mm-hmm. is that the love of Jesus, the love of God, is as scandalous and subversive today as it was in first century Palestine.
Yeah.
So,
goodness.
There you have it, right?
And, I mean, it really was the mention of LGBT persons and Muslims that caused the publisher to turn away from it?
Well, there's no doubt about that at all. Because when they first read the manuscript, my editor told me that he really loved it. He sent an email to me and my agent saying how much he appreciated it, how it was beautifully written. And then he said, there's just one thing I need to talk to you about on the phone. And given the tone of the email, we thought that would be a minor thing. And then I got on the phone with him, and he said, and I'm quoting, he said, it's the gays and the Muslims. That is a problem with the book. And I said, well, I don't understand what you're saying. You know, what do you mean? And he said, some of the stories you're telling are not in line with the values of the majority of readers. And he kept repeating that, you know. And so there is no doubt in anyone's mind that that's exactly what went on. And then they took the liberty of rewriting those two chapters in the manuscript, deleting certain stories wholesale, deleting almost 4,000 words, and sending it back to me. So there's absolutely no question the reason why ultimately, you know, it couldn't be published. But they also gave me the option of just cutting them out, and then they would publish it. And that's where my integrity had to come into play, because they said, when I refused to cut them, they said, well, then you're fired, and we own the book because you paid us, you know, we paid you to write it, mm-hmm. so you have to pay us back all the money your annual salary, you know, that we paid you in order to get the rights of the book back.
Goodness.
So I actually lost the book and the rights there for several months.
Good grief. Jacqueline, what is the very real harm to members of excluded groups, as well as critically to the people who are doing the excluding?
What a profound question. Thank you for that. I think the real harm could be answered with a story that my dear friend who lives here in Fargo with me, who's a Muslim, I think her story, I can answer your question. The other day, she was out for a walk with a dear friend, and she's lived here for longer than I have. She's lived in Fargo for 20-plus years,
mm-hmm.
and she is clearly Muslim, you know, and wears a headscarf,
mm-hmm.
and she was out walking with a friend, and somebody drove by in a minivan in her own neighborhood. She was just, you know, a couple yards from her own home. And somebody leaned out the door of their car, and they spit on her, and they said, go back where you came from.
Mm.
And when we talk about real harm, we have to listen to those stories of members of our own communities, our brothers and sisters, and what's happening to them because a single story is being told. The single story being told about Muslims today, we all know what it is. Mm-hmm. They're all terrorists. They're all members of ISIS. What a tragic thing. You know, there's 1.6 billion Muslims in the world. And to think that they all believe, act, and worship and do the same things in life is tragic. If I was judged by the action of every Christian, well, I wouldn't even be able to walk out the door of my house.
Mm-hmm.
And so when you ask what's being done, those are the kinds of things that are being done. People believe the single story. They treat the person as if they were guilty of things that they have not ever done. You know, my gay friends who adopted that baby, they're Christians.
Mm-hmm.
And I think when people hear that story, they think of them as not Christians, just because whatever, because they're members of the LGBTQ community. But they are devout Christians. Asked me to pray for them and their adopted son for all those years that they were raising him. So that's the answer to that question.
Well, when this happens, what does that do to talking about an authentic gospel message?
Yeah, it takes away from the liberating message of the gospel, which is simply this, that everyone without exception is a beloved child of God. No exceptions.
Mm-hmm.
And whenever we try to make exceptions in our practice or our words or our media or our sound bites, that leads to people's lives actually being wounded,
mm-hmm.
and they're the walking wounded. You know, that they lose friends, they can't make friends, they can't be in their community. And I was reading just recently, the most recent survey shows that because of folks who have, because of anti-Muslim bigotry in our country,
mm-hmm.
the most recent statistics show that Muslims in America have a higher rate of depression than any other group. I was shocked. I just read that yesterday.
Yeah.
And, much higher than the norm. And I think that we know the reasons for that if we dig deep.
When you talk about the love of Jesus, which is all-inclusive with no exceptions, and you're talking with someone who, for whatever reason, is not related to an institution that is in Jesus' name, how do you talk about love to that person? Do you have to say Jesus' love in order to describe the kind of love that everyone could have?
Well, that's a great question. I think, too, when I am face-to-face with folks who have been disillusioned and perhaps disappointed or hurt by institutional Christianity, I like to ask them their story.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the places that I start, because it's often a story of woundedness, right? They have a good reason, or it's that their friend was wounded, right? So they have good reasons for where they are. And so I always begin by listening. And I also would have to say, too, you know, Jesus, I'm a Christian, and so that's, you know, my primary touch point, my touchstone is Jesus, and that's where I learn. But I teach world religions, you know, at a college. I teach Islam. I teach Buddhism.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I teach Hinduism. I teach about Gandhi. I teach about Muhammad. And these leaders were, you know, radical peace builders. They were the teachers of radical love,
mm-hmm.
within their traditions.
Right.
And so one does not have to confine oneself to Jesus to find this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's this amazing book by Karen Armstrong called 12 Steps to the Compassionate Life.
Mm-hmm.
And she looks at all the world's religions, and I'm teaching that right now in my class, and she describes the ways in which every one of the world's religions teaches this profound, without exceptions, compassion and love towards the neighbor. You know, the golden rule exists in every single world religion.
Mm-hmm.
And so we don't have to confine this conversation to just Christians or just folks who are associated with Christianity. Again, everyone is welcome at this table.
Jacqueline Bussey is the award-winning author of the book Outlaw Christian, Finding Authentic Faith by Breaking the Rules, and a sought-after speaker on issues of faith and life, interfaith, peace-building, and the radical love of God and neighbor. She teaches religion, theology, and interfaith studies classes at Concordia College in Moorhead, Minnesota. where she also serves as the director of the Forum on Faith and Life. Dr. Bussey's new book is titled Love Without Limits, Jesus' Radical Vision for Love with No Exceptions. The conversation is a part of Whosoever You Love, our semi-monthly series affirming the worth and full value of LGBT persons within and beyond religion. It's supported by the Arcus Foundation, dedicated to the idea that people can live in harmony with one another and the natural world. You can learn more about Arcus and its partners at arcusfoundation.org and find additional resources on Whosoever You Love at stateofbelief.com. Jacqueline, you're always welcome here on State of Belief Radio.
Thank you so much. I was honored to be here today, and thank you for all that you do.
We introduced to you a new organization, Church Clarity, when it first launched last year. Thankfully, it has continued to grow and expand, and will be offering a webinar explaining methodologies and answering questions this coming week. Now, ahead of that, I'm pleased to be able to offer an update here on State of Belief, as I'm joined by Church Clarity co-founder Sarah New, who will be leading that webinar. Sarah, welcome back to State of Belief Radio.
Hi, I'm glad to be on.
For listeners who may not have heard our first segment on Church Clarity, take a moment and explain what the group's goals are.
Our mission is to raise the standard of clarity in churches, and particularly around clarity of their policies, at least for this first phase. These days, most churches, their front door are their websites, not even necessarily their physical front doors.
Mm-hmm.
And so most people, to find out much about church, they go to the website to figure out what it's about. And we think that it should be basic, standard, accessible knowledge that if you go to a church website, that you should be able to know what their policies are regarding LGBTQ people and women in leadership. And too often, I think a lot of queer folks or women or both get involved in church, are very invested, and then find out the truth a little bit too late after they've already been invested. And the human cost and sense of pain and betrayal of that can be pretty high. So we wanted to, you know, it's a kind of a harm reduction model, figure out we're not here to change church policies, but just want them to explicitly communicate that so that, you know, a first-time visitor can find that out.
And does this involve all kinds of churches?
Yes, all kinds of churches. At this point, though, our focus is on Protestant churches within mm-hmm. the United States of America and Canada, so North America.
Mm-hmm.
Just because the Catholic Church is a little bit tricky how we would score policy, but that is something we're definitely keeping in mind for the next phase. We have a fair number of churches in the UK and Australia who are submitted to us. But because our volunteer team is mostly American-based,
mm-hmm.
We try to sort of stick within our expertise.
Sarah, why do you consider this to be so important?
You know, the way I like to think about it is if we walk into a business and they said, this thing costs $5, so when I go to the checkout counter, it actually costs $10, that would be in some ways illegal. That would be false advertising. Or if I were to get a job at a company, you know, I'm queer, I'm a woman, and I'm very happily employed, and I want to apply for promotion, and they tell me, oh, actually, you can't, you're not eligible for promotion because you're a woman. You know, that would just be like, if I told that story to anyone, anyone would be outraged. I think that's so unjust. But for some reason, we give churches and religious organizations more of a pass, even though, arguably, the stakes are even higher because it has to do with people's spiritual, moral, emotional health and well-being, and mental health and well-being. So it seems to me that so much of particularly the evangelical churches operate in obscurity and in opacity, which creates a disadvantage and asymmetry of power. If I have information and I'm not disclosing it to you, I'm able to manipulate the situation in ways that are good for me. Mm-hmm. And we're in some ways trying to equalize power dynamics and bring a bit more accountability and clarity into sort of the church industrial complex.
Sarah, you're one of the founders of Church Clarity. What caused this? What happened in your life that made you want to do this?
So I am one of the co-founders, but the sort of original person with an idea is George McHale, and I can tell a little bit of his story. He used to be the executive pastor of a mega church in Eastlake, called Eastlake in Seattle area. And it was one of the first churches to come out as open and affirming of LGBTQ people. And, you know, the church lost half its members, half its donors. But what George found interesting was that a lot of pastors would reach out privately and say, I actually agree with you. I support you. I commend you. But I could never actually change any policy in my church. And I can preach welcoming and inclusive sermons, but I can't actually change, like, who is allowed to lead a small group, who is allowed to be married, was allowed to be a pastor. Mm-hmm. And he just recognized there's a disconnect between the rhetoric and practice. And I think he and I and my other co-founder have been in the evangelical world for a long time. My father's a missionary pastor. I've been involved in a lot of evangelical organizations. And we sort of recognized there's some sort of unhealth in what was going on. I have some other particular stories, but they have less to do with me personally and more about my observations, mm-hmm. Particularly the experiences of queer Christians in churches.
Would you talk about why the work you're doing is not anti-religion, as some conservatives inevitably shriek, but is in fact pro-religion and pro-people of faith?
Yeah, I think we are trying to empower people of faith with the information that they need to make the best decisions for their spiritual life. So if, you know, plenty of queer people go to churches that, for instance, do not officiate same-sex weddings or don't allow queer people to be deacons. And that's their choice. I mean, that's totally fine. They love the church for other reasons. We're not here to tell people, don't go to those churches, go to these churches. We just think that you should make decisions based on full information. Mm-hmm. And anything other than that is disrespectful to you. And I think in some ways, immoral. It's deceitful. And so I think what we're doing comes from Christian values. I mean, if you take what Jesus says, like, let your yes be yes. You know me, no. If you know the truth shall set you free. There's so much in the Bible about honesty and truth and standing for what you believe. So I think we really believe that clarity is a reasonable standard and that many conservative churches, if they truly have these convictions, should, I think, be like forthcoming about their convictions. It seems to me weird that they would, any argument against it, I don't know how you could find a Christian argument against it.
Mm-hmm. Since the founding of Church Clarity, what have you been able to achieve that you're most proud of?
It's a good question. We've had, I think as of today, 2,400 churches submitted to our database. We have a really solid team of about 20 volunteers who review their submissions, edit them, score them, essentially do a lot of investigative work to figure out, based on what evidence there is online connected to the church website, a church denomination, how to score the church. So we give it a clear or unclear score and also an affirming, a non-affirming, or egalitarian, non-egalitarian score. Hmm. So I think I am quite proud of what we've been able to accomplish, the team we've built, but more specifically, I think we've been able to try to shift the discourse away from debating theology or debating if something is loving or something is bigoted or hateful, and really kind of introduce sort of more objective, clear terms into the discourse around women in leadership and queer Christians, just to say, well, actually, in some ways, it is simple yes or no. Will you hire, will you ordain, will you marry a queer person? You know, there are tons of theological things we can talk about. But when it comes to policy, it tends to be a neglected dimension of the conversation, and in some ways, it can cut through a lot of the sort of smoke screens in some ways in these discourse.
Talk about, please, the upcoming webinar. Who is it for? What goals do you have in mind?
Sure. We have a webinar coming up on the 18th. That will be at, I think, 12 p.m. Eastern time. So if you have a lunch break, please join us. I'll be leading it. The goal is to provide a sneak peek or insight look into how we score churches. We get lots of emails specifically from church leaders asking, you know, why was my church scored as unclear? Well, how do we become clear? How do we get our church on the database? And so I think specifically if you're involved in your church and you care about having a clear policy stated on your church website, or you're just interested in maybe volunteering with us, I would attend the webinar and we'll kind of like pull back the curtain and show you how the sausage is made. I think we do state our methodology pretty clearly on our website, but this would give you a bit more of an in-depth look into it.
Hmm. So how can interested persons join the webinar, and how can they help support Church Clarity?
If you go to churchclarity.org/webinar, the form is right there. There are many ways of support. One is to submit a church. If your church is not on our database, we have about 2,000, but obviously there are 350,000 churches, so please submit them. If you want to volunteer, definitely just reach out in the Contact Us page. And if you want to become an advocate, which is where you put your name and your photo and you say, I believe that clarity is reasonable, that is definitely an option. And actually, there is a donate button. I think we've taken it off, and we only limit donations to people who are involved in Church Clarity in some way, whether you're on a mailing list, whether you're an advocate, or whether you're a volunteer, just because we want to kind of make sure we're taking money from people who sort of believe in what we're doing.
Before we go, tell us briefly about the priorities for the organization in the next year or so.
Yeah. You know, I would say our top two priorities would be to raise enough money to build a robust technological platform and to keep growing a volunteer team. We really see this as a sort of tech product in many ways. We think there are many things that this could do to kind of you know, to use a buzzy word, disrupt church, how churches operate and present themselves. And we have a lot of visions for that. And we really need a lot of people to score all 350,000 churches here in America. So those are our top two.
Sarah New is co-founder of Church Clarity and coordinates the Volunteer Scoring Initiative and Database Organization. She'll be leading the webinar on Tuesday, September 18th. You can find details at churchclarity.org. Sarah, thanks so much for being with us today on State of Belief Radio.
Great. Thank you so much.
Well, that's all the time we have for this week's show. If you made a donation to State of Belief Radio this week, I want to say a sincere thank you. If you think there's value in the conversations we present and the voices we amplify in the midst of the gridlock our public rhetoric too often becomes, please make your contribution today. Find more information at stateofbelief.com. That's stateofbelief.com. Stay up to date by subscribing to the free weekly State of Belief podcast on iTunes or your favorite podcast platform. And take a moment to follow us on Facebook and Twitter. Our producer is Ray Kirstein. State of Belief Radio is a production of Interfaith Alliance. Become a member today at interfaithalliance.org. And be sure to join us next week for more stories from the intersection of religion, government, and politics. Until then, you all take care of each other. I'm Welton Gaddy. That's State of Belief.
I think it's time we stop, children. What's that sound? Everybody look what's going down.